David Murata is our guest. He's the president of Murata Wealth Management. You read him in the daily newspaper now in the Sunday edition with some terrific columns he and his daughter write every week for your edification. We're talking today about Margaret Thatcher's economics, and it's not a subject that I've thought about for a long, long time. David Murata, welcome back to The Shilling Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, when we think about Margaret Thatcher, it's been a long time since she's been in the public eye, and yet she was still referenced over the previous decades on many occasions. Many people admired her, the way that she managed the country and guided it through times of crisis. What do you remember most, or what do you think about most when you think about Margaret Thatcher?
Yeah, it's interesting. Ronald Reagan and she were certainly economic and political soulmates in terms of returning conservatism to the forefront. But Reagan tended to cast the leftists as misguided. Even in the debate with Jimmy Carter, he would say, you know, there you go again, Mr. President. And he had a very genial way of just sort of saying, you don't understand how this works, and so you're dangerous. Margaret Thatcher was much more offensive. She was had a much harsher approach. Hmm. She would say, you know how this works, and you're harmful. You're actually making things worse, and you're doing it for political power and political gain.
Wow.
And so within Great Britain, even to this day, she is both loved and hated. I was watching one reviewer say she was just evil. She was terrible. Even after her death, he had nothing good to say about her and said, you know, she's awful. So I think she is. I mean, if Reagan is disliked in this country by a small minority of left-wing people, Margaret Thatcher is disliked by a large group of left-wing people. They really disliked her. And what's interesting to me is that when she was coming to power in the 1970s, there was what she would describe as a British post-war disease of socialism, state intervention, debauched currency, weakened incentives. And so I think it has a message for our day, because I think today we stand at the same forefront of two different paths we can go on, and we can continue to debauch our currency and ruin our incentives and head towards socialism, or we can take some of her words to heart. And she would probably, if she were an American housewife today, she would be at the Tea Party rallies as mad as can be and saying we are upset and you are doing this and it's evil.
You mentioned her rise to power and going back to the 1970s, but what do we know about her before that? Was she always an activist, or had she led a quiet life up until the point she decided to attain a national status in politics?
Yeah, her father was, I think, a baker of humble means, but he was very interested in these kinds of things and raised her to be active in politics. And I think she fulfilled some of what he would have fulfilled had he been born of a higher stature in Britain. So I think from a very early age, she was interested in politics and got a lot of her, I think, moral sense and moral compass from her father. So she was very, very ordinary. She was, I think you would say, a typical British conservative housewife. And she had to undergo a transformation in order to rise to political power. So she learned to slow down her speech. She learned to speak less shrilly.
Mm-hmm.
She took, I think Sir Laurence Olivier helped her get speech lessons in order to have her tone be less shrill and less harsh. Even within her own party, you know, she was sort of known as that woman. And I think she had to learn to measure her words and to have that gravitas of being a little less shrill and a little bit more firm. But I don't think she ever lost the fire behind it of the outrage of what was happening in Britain. When she took power, the top marginal tax rate was 98%.
Ouch. It's almost hard to imagine that. And, you know, when you say she was known as that woman, I think, gosh, in the United States, that woman is Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah, there you go.
or maybe Marlo Thomas, if you twist the words a little bit. But in England, that woman. And that brings to mind another question, which was, you know, was it the same for her to rise to power as a woman? Were there the same barriers that there would be for a woman becoming president of the United States? Because that's a country that's used to being governed, or at least by a figurehead queen. So did she face those barriers?
Yeah, I think she was the first head of a Western democracy ever. A major. I could be wrong on that, but I don't know of another major democracy where
Goldemeyer. Or would that not qualify?
I don't know. It's a good question. Maybe she was second, but I think she had. I think she had the same barriers of a conservative woman, and that is, she, you know, a conservative isn't supposed to be a woman. The women are supposed to be liberals,
mm-hmm.
and so her own party kind of looked a little askance at her because they weren't really sure of her credentials, and they didn't have as many women in politics. And the other side, you know, just sort of tried to demonize her in a thousand different ways and dismiss her as, you know, not really serious and not really about politics and on and on like that. But she was as critical of her own party, I think, sometimes as she was of the Labour Party. The Tories had been complicit in all of this. We're going to let labor union bosses set monetary policy, even though they've never been elected. We're going to compromise on conservative values. And her two guiding principles were: do not compromise conservatism, and when in doubt, fight.
I love both of those, and this is great. And maybe we can pick this up on the other side, because we have some callers to the program who talk about this very frequently. You know, the reason that we're in the trouble we are right now in the United States is because the people who were supposedly conservatives, some of them are Republicans, they did compromise their values going back to the 60s, 50s, 40s, and even before that in some cases. And that led us to where we were, because they just wanted to get along and they kept giving ground.
Yeah, we have our rhinos, Republicans in name only. They had their tinos, you know, Tories in name only. And I think she blamed her own party for that. And she said, we've got to return to conservative values, and we can't compromise on our principles.
Well, the fact that she was able to say it so plainly, that's a voice that we need today, and we need it here in America. I'm not even sure if England's salvageable. I'm not even sure if America's salvageable. But I want to get into more of this with David Morata when The Shilling Show returns after the news and weather at the bottom of the hour. You can give us a call right now at 977-1070 if you'd like to get in line, a comment, or a question. Talking about Margaret Thatcher, her economics, and her leadership right here on The Shilling Show. Stay with us. We're talking about the economics and the political history of Margaret Thatcher, her impact on the world, and certainly on the United States, her alliance with Ronald Reagan. David Morata is our guest. He's online at moratamoney.com, and we certainly welcome your point of view at 977-1070 as Luke stands by to take your calls. You know, Margaret Thatcher has been proven right, and we were talking off the air about her changing her mind on some issues, and one of them was the euro. Many people may not be aware that England maintained its own currency, one of few during this discussion that did so, still has a pound sterling, and yet there was a lot of pressure at the time, and Margaret Thatcher herself was even mildly favoring getting into the European Union.
Yeah, her party was all in favor of it. They thought the free trade, that what appealed to them was the free trade aspects of the European Union, and they thought having one currency would help facilitate that. But there's a quote from Thatcher: "The European single currency is bound to fail economically, politically, and indeed socially, though the timing, occasion, and full consequences are all necessarily still unclear." And she even went on to sort of say that Germany. Powerhouses like Germany and smaller countries like Greece couldn't sort of make that transition, because Germany would be phobic about inflation, while the euro would prove fatal to the poorer countries because it would devastate their inefficient economies. And she was wary of being sucked into a European Union that was really pan-democratic, meaning mm-hmm. that the leaders of this European Union would not be democratically elected. And she thought the nation state was the optimum size, and this pan conglomeration just would not work.
Was she fearful? Or did she ever say she was fearful of some of the lesser countries basically having to be propped up and supported by the wealthier, more successful countries like Great Britain?
Yes. In fact, she thought that because a lot of the southern European countries were really more socialist in nature, she said, and this is another quote, "We have not successfully rolled back the frontiers of the state in Britain, only to see them reimposed at a European level." So she really, and she went on to talk about how countries trade with each other, or to be more precise, people buy and sell from each other across frontiers, because that's the way to advance their interests. They don't need to beg people to trade with them as long as you have something that people want. So so the whole aspect that currencies can necessarily help facilitate trade is just not true. And people really don't understand how currencies work. But Thatcher did, and keeping the pound sterling strong was one of her sort of crowning achievements in Britain. When she took power, Britain had a 27% inflation rate. That's amazing.
Wow.
We never got that bad in the United States when Reagan and Volcker had to break the back of inflation. It still wasn't that high. You know, it was high, but not that high. She reduced it from 27% down to 2.5.
Amazing.
So that's what she did for the currency. And I think she knew that the euro was going to go the way of higher inflation naturally as a result of all of the socialistic countries within Europe.
She has a great quote, and I'll have to paraphrase. I don't have it in front of me, but she said the problem with socialism is that sooner or later you run out of other people's money, or words to that effect.
Yeah, I mean that's probably her most famous quote, and she really did view socialism as an evil, and socialistic thinking, even in its milder forms, as abhorrent. And so she just went on and on like that. Another one of her great quotes is, "Socialists cry power to the people and raise the clenched fist as they say it. We all know what they really mean, power over people, power to the state." And I think that's the way she viewed a lot of the feel-good legislation that really enslaves some people to other people in the form of entitlements.
And that is a great way of putting it. She realized all of these things, and she obviously had some good foresight to anticipate what would happen here. Who were her idols? Who did she study? How did she learn all of this economic wisdom? Do you know?
Yeah, her greatest political mentor was a man by the name of Sir Keith Joseph, and he is one of the ones who sort of got her started. He believed that in 1947 or 1945, you know, the people of Britain had chosen the wicked path of socialism, and that much of the much of what was going on in Britain and the malaise of Britain was a direct result of those decisions. And he founded a think tank called the Center for Policy Studies. And Margaret Thatcher, he chose to be the first vice chairman. And she was really one of his disciples in terms of that think tank. It shows you the power of think tanks and the power of conservatives coming together to try to develop policy that's not just reactive to the socialism around us, but is actually proactive to try to figure out and what can politically be changed, which we can get through. And Margaret Thatcher really believed that a lot could get changed. She didn't believe that there was something that was impossible to do. And so she would just hammer at it and fight at it and fight at it until finally she could push it through.
It's an amazing story. We're talking about Margaret Thatcher and her economics, her rule over England in a very glorious time for that country, time of rebirth. 977-1070 is the phone number. Our guest is David Murata. What about these differences between Thatcher and Reagan? You mentioned the style as far as how they would address their political opponents, but there's a lot of people who try to say, well, they didn't really like each other that much. They try to put a wedge in between them. I don't know if you've heard that, but I certainly have. Were there major differences between these two?
On the political scale, not really. Mm-hmm. Both of them took on unions, Reagan with air traffic controllers. Margaret Thatcher had to do it much more forcibly in Britain because unions really were the opposition party. And in breaking unions in England, in Great Britain, she really changed the opposition party even more than she changed her own party.
How did she do that? I'm just so curious because you referenced PATCO, the air traffic controllers that Reagan basically fired, one of the greatest days, I think, in American domestic history when he took that bold step. What did Thatcher do?
Yeah, she removed the legal immunities that protected unions from the financial consequences of their actions. That was one of the biggest things she did. So they had legal protections that no one else in society could have. And then what she ended up doing is she took on the coal unions. The head of the coal union really hated her and was going to do a strike. And so what she started doing was she started stockpiling coal just for a coal strike. And so she wanted to make sure that they could not break her that way, that England could continue even in the midst of a coal strike. And then the coal union picked, unfortunately, the spring to do their strike when coal is not needed as much for heating. And the coal strike lasted an entire year. The union boss did it without a vote of the union. So many of the union members, since there was no vote, crossed the picket line and decided to go to work anyway. So there was enough opposition. There was enough turmoil among the opposition and enough foresight on her part as to be able to survive an entire year of coal strike. And after that, the unions were really never the same. They had picked their battle. They had lost their battle, and she had won, and she had gotten through a lot of the legal implications to say they could no longer run the government since they were not elected officials.
977-1070 is the phone number of the final segment of this hour of The Shilling Show with David Marotta. We're talking about this economic legacy of Margaret Thatcher and her theories of economics, how they changed not only her own country, but impacted the world in many good ways. We'll be back with our final segment in just a moment. Stay with us. Oops, I must have pressed the wrong button. Sorry. Welcome back to The Shilling Show. I just didn't want to hear that voice. I did not want my airwaves sullied. 977-1070 is the phone number. David Marotta is our guest of Marotta Wealth Management, online at MarottaOnMoney.com. Some great resources there for you. We're talking about Margaret Thatcher. And I want to talk to you about this whole issue of the British pound, which I believe was once the reserve currency of the world. Is that correct?
It was, certainly before World War II.
And how did it happen to, because these are good lessons for us today, how did it happen to lose reserve currency? And let's talk about the debasement of this currency.
Yeah, I mean, it's said that England went from an empire on which the sun never set to a commonwealth on which it never rises because of their rainy weather. Mm. And I think really after World War II, Britain was not in as good a state as America. America was in a much better state. And our getting into World War II late and then winning on all fronts and the production of the American people and the capacity of the American people to rise to that occasion really made the U.S. dollar then take over from the pound sterling. It's still a strong currency. It's certainly, I think, stronger than the euro, and there are times at which it continues to do better.
What did she do in order to shore that currency up and the lessons we can learn?
She had the audacity to say that a currency is strong when you don't print a lot of it.
Wow, she just said it like it was, huh?
And it's amazing. I mean, there were all kinds of economic theories at the time that said, you know, it's not the currency. It has to do with supply, demand, economy, and her own party and the other party were both saying, you know, that we're in a recession. We need to print lots of money in order to get out of it and Keynesian economics and all of that. And she simply said, no, we need to get a handle on the money supply and we need to make sure that the money supply is not out of whack and that will reduce inflation. And it did. It began to work. And just like Reagan and Volcker did here, it caused a high unemployment spike. And, you know, in the early 1980s, we had high unemployment here in the United States.
This is explain the connection between this tightening of the money supply and the high unemployment. What happens?
Yeah, if money is worth nothing and is going down in value, then it's easy to spend it and it's easy to get it because there's more of it every day. And it's not hard to spend money. And so what you don't want to do is you don't want to conserve money. You just want to spend it as fast as possible. And that usually produces a higher rate of employment. But there's no real value behind it. It's just everyone's working really hard for dollars today because dollars tomorrow aren't worth anything. So when you tighten up the money supply and money becomes tight, it becomes tight all across the boards. And so it's true. Businesses spend less money because they know that they can keep the money and use it for something useful in the future. They don't have to to immediately just get rid of it. And as much as Keynesians like to say people getting rid of money as fast as they can is good economics, it's just the flailing of a drowning person trying to stay above water when they're sinking the currency as fast as they can. And so when people can stay above water, they have to flail less. And so that means there was less flailing, and flailing is often just spending money wildly. So that produced a spike in unemployment because businesses didn't just have to keep doing things. And that spike in unemployment was large in Great Britain, just as it was large here. And she was accused of of starving babies and starving families and all the things like that. And she had to just take that heat, knowing that it was the right thing in the long run. In fact, there was there's a book about her, and the title was "There's No Alternative," and it comes from an old Oxford Don of Margaret Thatcher's, who admitted, much as he loathed Thatcher's policies, that perhaps there wasn't any other way to reverse Britain's relative decline. And she even ended up saying things like, "There is no alternative. This is the only way out. Mm. There is this way, or there's the worse way of drowning." And so the unemployment was weathered, and then Britain entered an incredible prosperity, just like America did in the 1980s. And so the medicine worked, if you will. The ship righted. The person stopped drowning, and we were back on a firmer footing.
If we look at modern day politics in Great Britain, are there people today? I mean, we have people who claim the mantle of Reagan, even Barack Obama, which is laughable, but some people who really do try to reference Reagan in a sincere way. Are there people like that in England who reference Thatcher and they're Thatcherites?
I think Margaret Thatcher, because she was ultimately ousted even by her own party in a party coup vote, is less people take up her mantle less. True conservatives do, but I think true conservatives are very rare these days. And so a lot of people will point to Thatcher and Reagan and say, we need to do that. Probably more in the United States pointing to Reagan than in Britain pointing to Thatcher. I was always surprised at the last Olympics where, you know, Great Britain was celebrating their socialized mm-hmm. medicine and that seems to have won the day in Britain, just as it seems to have won the day in the United States. It's just harmful. It's just evil. And our I'll be Thatcher a little bit. Our policies of socialization mean that we deserve what we're getting these days in terms of our economics.
So, you know, the problem is, and I agree with you. I mean, we get the government that we vote for, and we get the government we deserve. But there's a whole lot of people in this country and maybe a smaller number in England that would just as soon not be subject to all of this. We don't want it. We don't deserve it because we were smart enough not to vote for it. I mean, where do we go from here? Do we go form our own country? Do we all move to Texas and try and put up a fence around the place and withdraw from the federal government? Because it just seems like people aren't getting it.
Yeah, I think if Margaret Thatcher can teach us one lesson, she can teach us the lesson that if you don't compromise conservative values, and when in doubt, fight, you can actually change the world.
And this is what's been coming up on this program time and time again, when people calling in and saying, you know, we need to fight. And some people get very offended by that. They take that as some sort of a challenge. They don't like it. But it's very true that the other side, the leftists, the progressives, the socialists, have been fighting both overtly and covertly for generations now. And that's why we are where we are.
This is another quote from Margaret Thatcher. When the objectives of government include the achievement of equality, other than equality before the law, that government poses a threat to liberty. Mm-hmm. And I think when your liberty is threatened, you ought to fight. There are things worth, you know, they may call us contentious, but there are things that are worth contending for. They you know, this country was founded on a battle and a fight for freedom, and it was founded on the idea of liberty. And if not liberty, then we're not the American people that were founded. So I think America is an idea, and therefore fighting over these ideas is what makes us Americans. It's the most important thing. And even Margaret Thatcher, when she was trying to figure out should she look more across the Atlantic or across the English Channel, she continually said, all of the ideology that I agree with is across the Atlantic, and so I don't know why I would form a union with Europe when I'd much rather form the union with the United States.
What a fascinating thing, you know, because so many of those ideals came from people that came here from there, and so the circle kind of completes itself. Are there any remnants of her economics that are still in practice there? Because it almost seems like that nation has really taken a sharp turn to the left since she's left.
It certainly has, and I know Great Britain has lost a lot in the Heritage Foundation's Index of Economic Freedom, although the United States in the last 3 years has the dubious distinction of being one of the three countries who've lost the most freedoms. Mm. I think Great Britain's was a more gradual slide after Margaret Thatcher, but they're still among the mostly free categories. So they're still up there with, you know, Germany and Sweden and Norway and Netherlands and Denmark. And I think they were right to stay out of the Union because those countries, a lot of those are in the European Union and getting pulled down by the pig countries, Portugal, mm-hmm. Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain, who are really much more socialistic in nature. And I think, you know, are pulling down the euro. So she did a lot, and probably her best achievement was keeping Europe out of the euro and out of a single currency. She certainly has a legacy in Great Britain that conservatives can return to, and she certainly taught us that fighting is worth it, is better than not fighting for conservative values.
You know, we have an invitation now that I threw something out on the air from our friend Keith Drake, who listens in live from Texas now. He says, Texas would welcome you and David. So I guess if we need an escape plan, we do have a place to go, and the arms are wide open in Texas for us.
Texas is certainly a bastion of American freedom, and I think Texas would not secede from the Union. They would just invite the Union to secede from them.
I like that. David Morata, always a good time when you're here, and a great history lesson for us today. Thanks so much for being with us today on The Shilling Show.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, you could visit him online, moratamoney.com. We're going to head into the break. We'll have open phones for you at the top of the next hour. And by the way, if you'd like to get in line, Luke is standing by right now. You could be the first one up by calling and just holding on through the news break. It's 977-1070, 977-1070. This is The Shilling Show, where all points of view are welcome, including and especially yours, at 977-1070. Oh, a new candidate for the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors. We'll talk about that when The Shilling Show returns.